Lexi, KBXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. Aisha Roscoe, good morning. The federal government could shut down if Congress is unable to reach an agreement by Tuesday night. We talked to Democratic Senator Andy Kim about the state of negotiations. And looking at screens all day is not great for your eyes, but not for the reason you might think.
The real reason for your digital eye strain is likely much simpler. When we look at screens, we tend to blink less.
You need to blink, y'all. And maybe some artificial tears. Plus, a review of the new movie from director Paul Thomas Anderson, One Battle After Another. It's Sunday, September 28th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Minnesota regulators are considering testimony they heard Thursday on a proposed acquisition that could set a new tone in the world of public utilities. A decision is expected soon on whether Minnesota Power should be sold to a private equity firm. The Public Utilities Commission votes next week on a petition for purchase of the utility by Global Infrastructure Partners. The Canada Pension Plan Investment Board would be minority owners. A recent settlement with the State Commerce Department added some conditions, but Maggie Schupert with the rural community advocacy group CURE says they still worry the new owners will focus on profits, setting a dangerous precedent.
Clearly, if this deal goes through, private equity interests, they see the arguments against it shot down, they're going to know that our utility sector across the country is open for business.
Schupert and other opponents contend that because of how the deal is structured, ratepayers could face higher utility bills. Utility officials say the new owners would give them financial flexibility to meet the state's mandate for carbon-free electricity by 2040. In a non-binding opinion this summer, an administrative law judge said the deal would not be in the public's interest. The PUC vote is expected October 3rd. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. An attempt to create a new statewide nonprofit health system with the University of Minnesota and Fairview and Essentia Health Systems has ended. Chelsea Perkins explains.
The Minnesota Star Tribune reports that people close to the negotiations who were not authorized to speak on the record said there was an impasse over the proposed structure, leading to Essentia Health exiting the talks. This leaves the U with limited time to create a new agreement for the long-term future of the medical school with its current partner, Fairview Health Services, which is set to expire at the end of 2026. The university operates the state's largest and only public training program for physicians, and the medical school uses Fairview's University of Minnesota Medical Center as its primary teaching hospital. The Essentia Health proposal was announced in January and called for creating an all-Minnesota health system solution that would include a $1 billion joint investment over 5 years. A person close to the talks said Essentia opted out of negotiations after it became clear Fairview would not merge into a proposed new nonprofit health system led by Essentia. In a statement shared with KAXE on Thursday, Essentia Health confirmed it is no longer part of the mediation through the Attorney General's office. Essentia says this is because the strategic facilitator determined the provider no longer had a role in the process. But they say that process is distinct from broader conversations happening with the university to support the medical school in, quote, preparing the current and future healthcare workforce. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
Leech Lake Tribal Council members, Itasca County Commissioners, and even State Senator Mary Kunish broke ground Friday for a new community and wellness center in Ball Club. It's the third such groundbreaking this year, following the state legislature's 2023 investment for three wellness centers on the Leech Lake Reservation. Kunish says the investment was long overdue.
They will take our land and in exchange provide housing, health care, education, opportunity to, you know, have a trade that would be able to be sustainable for our communities. And we know that our federal government and even our state government never really upheld those agreements.
Ball Club's representative on the Tribal Council, Kyle Smith, says these centers serve a huge role in Indigenous communities.
Our communities are very tight-knit. You know, we rely on families for supports and family gatherings. Mm-hmm. And it's just a way of life for for our native communities.
The Leech Lake Band also formally entered into a memorandum of understanding with Itasca County, which Commissioner John Johnson commemorated with a special gift to Chairman Farron Jackson.
I hope that this unfinished pipe is as meaningful to you and the council as it is to me, because I hope it is exactly like the relationship between Itasca County and the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and that it remains unfinished.
Construction on the new wellness centers is expected to take about 1 year. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Thanks for tuning in. President Donald Trump will meet tomorrow with top congressional leaders from both parties. The White House meeting comes just 1 day before a deadline to approve legislation to avoid a government shutdown. For the latest on the negotiations and what it means for civil services, we're joined now by Senator Andy Kim. He's a Democrat representing New Jersey. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Senate leaders John Thune and Chuck Schumer and House leaders Mike Johnson and Hakeem Jeffries will meet with President Trump tomorrow. What do you expect to come out of that meeting?
Well, I'm glad this meeting is happening, and I'm glad that President Trump changed his mind. I think it shows that the president is feeling pressure from his position before of saying that he doesn't want to deal with Democrats, doesn't want to negotiate. And I think that's because the American people are feeling a lot of pain right now. You know, I'm here in New Jersey going around my state. People here have been telling me overwhelmingly about just the continued challenges that they're facing in terms of cost of living, healthcare, and housing. And they want relief. And they don't see that from Donald Trump right now.
What is the party's strategy, your party's strategy, going into these negotiations?
Well, the negotiations are about addressing these exact needs from the American people. You know, they're terrified about their healthcare costs. Starting October 1st, we're going to see healthcare costs increase dramatically for so many Americans. And we want to make sure that that is addressed by this president, by this Republican administration that has done so much to be able to hurt them by gutting Medicaid and so many other issues. So we're going to be fighting to be able to lower those costs for Americans and help them be able to address the needs in their families.
If Republicans are unwilling, as they have said, to roll back some of those changes that came from the spending bill that was passed earlier this year, that's going to affect Medicaid, that's going to affect medical insurance, should Democrats hold out for a shutdown?
Well, look, you know, we'll see how the negotiations go tomorrow in terms of what Trump is willing to move on, because we know that, you know, Speaker Johnson and congressional Republicans, they're just doing whatever Trump is saying. So, you know, going, being able to talk to Donald Trump and see how much this pressure is coming down on him. You know, he is somebody that has said in the past that if a shutdown happens, that it's the president's fault. So we'll see how far he's willing to go. But what we need to make sure we're addressing here are the just high costs that people are facing. And just what I hear from people is just they just use the word chaos and they use the word exhausted. You know, they are exhausted by Donald Trump and they don't see this chaos as helping them. In fact, it's making things more unpredictable in their lives.
But if there is a shutdown, that would be chaotic too, right? The Trump administration has threatened mass firings across the government. If there's a shutdown, what would you say to those who will blame Democrats for that?
Well, no, I don't think they're going to blame Democrats because, I mean, look, even Donald Trump said, you know, it's the president's job to pull people together. You know, look, they see it as him unwilling to govern. right now, we're seeing a situation where Donald Trump is literally trying to take down and dismantle the other two branches of government. You know, that doesn't want to be able to do what we normally need to do in terms of being able to negotiate. And the American people are seeing that. You know, they're seeing that he is the focal point, the cause of this chaos in their lives.
Is there any plan for what would happen if the shutdown happens and more federal workers are let go? Is there a message that Democrats have? Is there a plan, you know, to try to support people who are losing their jobs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've been fighting all along to be able to support federal workers. I used to be a federal civil servant under both Republicans and Democratic presidents. I served through multiple shutdowns. I didn't get a paycheck despite working. I know how difficult this is, and I don't want to see this. But what we also see is just a blatant lawlessness from Donald Trump right now. And when they're threatening to fire federal employees, it comes across as just like, you know, straight up, you know, mafia, straight up, just like, you know, we're going to do whatever we want to do. And people don't want that. So, you know, I think it's going to backfire immensely on Donald Trump if he leads us down that path.
Should Americans be worried about essential services like weather forecasting and federal emergency response if there's a shutdown?
You know, having been through this multiple times, you know, we know some of the things that we're going to have to worry about. And that's what we're trying to close the gap on. You know, we want to be able to make sure that, you know, this is something that if a shutdown happens, if Donald Trump causes a shutdown, that we're going to try to minimize the damages and the challenges facing the American people. So, yes, that's part of the negotiations. You know, we're going to try to do our best to minimize it. If it gets to that, I hope we avoid it. You know, I hope Donald Trump comes to these negotiations willing to be able to address some of these needs that the American people are facing and show that, yes, you know, we need to make sure we come together at this time.
That's Senator Andy Kim of New Jersey. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump says he's ordered the deployment of troops to Portland, Oregon, and that he's authorized them to use, quote, full force to curb protests outside of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement facilities. It's the latest instance of Trump deploying the military to various cities that he says are plagued with crime. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has been following all this and joins us now. Welcome, Kat.
Hey, good morning.
So let's start with this latest announcement. What can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, like many of Trump's announcements, it started with a post on his social media platform, Truth Social. He called Portland, Oregon, quote, war ravaged, which, to be very clear, is not the case on the ground there, and said he had authorized the Pentagon to provide all necessary troops. It was unclear from that post what troops he meant. NPR reached out to the Pentagon for clarity, and a U.S. official who was not authorized to speak publicly said the Pentagon had not issued a deployment order for Portland and that it only learned of Trump's request from the media. That official also said it would be likely that National Guard troops would be used. Later, Chief Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said it was, quote, ready to mobilize.
And what's been the reaction from officials in Oregon?
Both the governor of Oregon and the mayor of Portland dispute Trump's claims that the city is unsafe or in need of troops and have been urging residents to remain peaceful. The governor has made it clear that she is not authorizing the use of Oregon's National Guard. In a press conference yesterday, Portland Mayor Keith Wilson said the necessary troops needed for the city is zero.
This is an American city. We do not need any intervention. This is not a military target.
All of this comes after there were reports of a ramp up of federal officers at an ICE facility in Portland on Friday, which Mayor Wilson called a show of force and told residents to remain calm and not react.
Trump has been making these kinds of threats against a variety of cities for months now.
Yeah.
Can you remind us of that larger picture?
Yeah, well, here in D.C., where Trump has federal control, more than 2,000 National Guard troops from a variety of states have been deployed for more than a month in what Trump has said is an effort to crack down on crime. Back in June, Trump federalized California's National Guard against Governor Gavin Newsom's wishes and deployed them, along with the Marines, to L.A. to quell protests against ICE deportations there. That sounds similar to what could happen in Portland. And then there are a handful of cities that Trump has threatened, about a dozen at this point, all Democrats. democratically led cities, places like Chicago, where he also used the war metaphor but has yet to actually send troops. We're also watching Memphis, Tennessee. Trump authorized the use of the National Guard there as part of a similar crackdown, along with other federal agents who are all expected to start arriving as early as this week. And I just want to note, you know, the National Guard is not trained for community policing or to make arrests. That's not how they're generally used. Here in D.C., they've mainly been patrolling federal property and beautifying city parks.
Each of the places you've mentioned is a little bit different, but is there a larger pattern that we're starting to see?
Yeah, Trump says these National Guard deployments are to deal with crime, but he also has been conflating them with immigration and deportations. We've seen that here in D.C., for example, where ICE agents moved in along with the National Guard deployment and started detaining people at high rates. Legal experts have also told me that another part of this that has them worried is the normalization of troops, sometimes armed, on U.S. streets, even if the deployment is largely performative. You know, the U.S. has a long history of limiting the role of the military domestically, and experts say these kinds of continued threats and deployments challenge laws that are centuries old and central to the ideas that the U.S. was founded on.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
One of the most popular dictionaries is getting an overhaul, adding some 5,000 new words. The 12th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary will include stuff the kids say, like Riz, Dad Bod, and Doom Scroll. The Collegiate Dictionary was first published in 1898, created for college students and professionals. It's where they can look up foreign words and geographical names like Washington and Waikiki. The latest version has added beast mode and hard pass. Other words in the new Collegiate Dictionary will include teraflop, which is a unit of measure for calculating the speed of a computer. Another is dumb phones. Those are, of course, what we all used before smartphones. We just didn't know they were dumb back then. The dictionary also includes the history of some words, like calculate. It comes from the Latin word for pebble, because that's what the ancient Romans used to do math. Dictionary sales have plummeted in recent years since people now go to the internet for word searches. But Greg Barlow, the president of Merriam-Webster, says some people still like to have a hard copy version. They're a way, he said, to preserve culture and history. The new Collegiate Dictionary will be released on November 18th, and at £5, lifting it in beast mode could help you address that dad bod. You're listening to NPR News.
You're tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Grand Rapids Arts, connecting artists and audience, encouraging creativity and collaboration through monthly First Friday art walks and more. Information is available at grandrapidsarts.org. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, along with the Cass and Crow Wing Soil and Water Conservation Districts, have a Smart Salting for Roads certification course Wednesday, October 8th from 8 to 1:30 in Bacchus. Learn how to maintain safe roads while reducing environmental impacts. The training is free, but registration is required by October 1st. Text KAXE for more information at 218-326-1234. The Range Area Walk to End Alzheimer's is Sunday, October 5th at Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm. Registration begins at noon, with the opening ceremony at 1 p.m. and the walk to follow. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. President Trump is to meet with top congressional Republicans and Democrats at the White House tomorrow. The meeting was confirmed by top congressional Democrats last night and comes a day before the deadline to fund government operations or face a partial shutdown. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs has declared a state of emergency in Globe, Arizona. Flooding devastated the town east of Phoenix Friday. At least four people were killed. Another storm yesterday forced authorities to temporarily halt a search for people possibly missing. And board members of Iowa's largest school district to place Superintendent Ian Roberts on paid leave. The Des Moines School Board met Saturday, a day after Roberts was arrested by federal immigration agents who say he was subject to a final removal order issued last year. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From Dignity Memorial, for many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Americans seem to really like their shrimp.
Ultimate Endless Shrimp is here with a limited time.
Remember the endless offer that caused Red Lobster to lose $11 million in 1 year? Well, much of the shrimp in the U.S., about 2 of every 5 pounds, used to come from one place. India. But in August, President Trump slapped 25% tariffs on many Indian industries. Then he doubled it as punishment for buying Russian oil. So we sent NPR's Dia Hadid to the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh, where shrimp exports are an economic backbone.
A woman heads home after a day looking for work in a coastal town of Andhra Pradesh. Sita used to make about $120 a month, peeling and packing shrimp all day in a processing plant, but she hasn't had a shift in weeks.
Husband, little, we're all single parents.
Sita's a single mother. It's all on her. For now, she's pulled her 2 teenage boys out of school. She's worried about the rent, worried about the $100 loan she took out last month to cover expenses. Sita's about one of a dozen women who tell NPR they haven't had a shift in weeks or they've had their hours curtailed. Sita asks that NPR only use her first name. She's worried about angering her boss and losing her job for good. The shrimp industry usually employs over 1 million people. From the fishmongers who sell their catch at the port to the fishwives who auction off pungent mounds of dried shrimp. But the biggest slice of the industry is farm, peeled and frozen shrimp, much of it shipped to America, or was shipped to America.
All the shipments have come to a halt.
Pawan Kumar Guntur runs a major shrimp processing and export company. He also heads India's Seafood Exporters Association, the central body for seafood exporters throughout India. He says tariffs have priced them out of the American market. Now they're keeping shrimp once meant for the US in storage while they look for new markets. He says it just needs time.
2 months, 3 months, 6 months, that's fine.
But another industry leader says most folks don't have the resources to wait it out. Their margins are so thin.
Farmer, they're getting mostly 5%. Trader, 5%. The export is also 5%.
Arjali Dasu leads a federation of Indian fishery groups. He says he's already seeing impacts down the line. Traders and exporters aren't buying wholesale shrimp from farmers.
Hey!
And that's why shrimp farmer Rajakrishnan Raju thinks this is his last harvest.
Very, very, very bad.
For 2 decades, Raju's raised premium shrimp in saltwater ponds.
Nearly one crop.
Birds try nab a few, a worker shoos them away. Raju says he's likely to lose thousands of dollars this year.
Destroy.
Economist Shumitra Chatterjee says this may be the fate of all sectors hit by Trump's tariffs.
There is no way that industry can take a 50% tariff. At that point, you are completely thrown out of the US market.
Chatterjee is an assistant professor of international economics at Johns Hopkins University, and he says the industries most at risk from Trump's tariffs,
apparel, footwear, leather, textile, even food processing,
are all labour intensive. They offer rare, reliable work, even if it's badly paid. The tariffs may be ruinous in India, and yet...
The tariffs are providing immediate relief for the U.S. shrimp industry.
Deborah Long is from the Southern Shrimp Alliance, based in Florida. She says American shrimpers have been devastated by foreign competitors who've been allowed
to use practices that are not allowed here in the United States and allow them to reduce costs.
Like Indian producers who pay peanuts and who use antibiotics to raise more shrimp faster. Antibiotics use is largely restricted in the US. Long says the alliance wants trade deals that enforce the same rules for everyone. But another expert says that isn't going to solve this problem.
There are big coastlines in the United States, and yet 96% of the seafood is imported. There's reasons for that.
Katrina Nakamura is from the Sustainability Incubator, a Hawaii-based nonprofit which investigates shrimp industries. She's reported on how American retailers have used their power over the market to drive down the price of shrimp to historic lows, even as she says they make historic profits. Unless retailers are reined in, Nakamura says they'll just find the next place prepared to cut corners to produce cheap shrimp. The same problem, a different country. Dee Hadid, NPR News, Bhimunipatnam, Andhra Pradesh, India.
Looking for another reason to be less glued to your devices? We have a big one for you. Eye health. According to recent research, digital eye strain, also known as computer vision syndrome, affects around 70% of us. One 2025 study found that just 1 hour of scrolling, especially on social media, can cause blurred vision, dry eyes, or headaches. But there are easy ways to care for your vision, and Andy Tagle from NPR's Life Kit is here to tell us about some of those. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Aisha.
So let's start with blue light. I know a lot of our devices emit this blue light, and there's all this concern that too much blue light could damage our eyes. Is that true?
Not true. So I talked to Dr. Rupa Wong about this. She's an ophthalmologist and professor at the Burns School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii. And she told me because blue light is so prevalent, it's often singled out as a bad guy, but actually, no studies have proven a negative effect from blue light specifically on any part of the eye.
I think people get a little confused with ultraviolet light and blue light. But what blue light does is it affects your melatonin. It affects your circadian rhythms.
So if you have a big TV or computer near your bed, blue light might mess with your sleep in the same way any other bright light would. But the real reason for your digital eye strain is likely much simpler. When we look at screens, we tend to blink less.
Is that what it is? So it just all comes down to blinking.
Yeah, that's it. So it turns out your tear film is responsible for a good part of the clarity of your vision.
People don't come in saying, I have dry eyes. They come in oftentimes saying, my eyes hurt or my vision is blurred. There are a lot of different medical problems that can be associated with severe dry eye syndrome.
Things like inflammation, infections, even damage to the cornea or corneal ulcers. So it's important to protect them.
How do we do that when so much of people's day-to-day work is looking at screens?
Yep, it's a fair point. I'm one of them. I've got options for you. So you could keep artificial tears handy, not eye drops. There's a difference. You could start or end your day with a few minutes of warm compresses over your eyes, and that moisturizes the oil glands on your eyelids. But my favorite is to practice the 20-20-20 rule. So for every 20 minutes of screen time, take a 20-second break and look 20 feet away. And that's not a precise number, mind you. You don't need a tape measure. It just means look at something off in the distance because when your eyes are looking farther away, they're more relaxed. And your eyes need that rest from your screens as well as any other types of near work. So, you know, reading, writing, sewing, because that close-up activity is associated with becoming nearsighted. And on that, I've got just one more tip to help, and it's pretty simple.
Okay, so what do you have for us?
Okay, you ready? It's just get outside. Because research suggests regular outside time for kids, like up to 2 hours a day, may help slow or even prevent nearsightedness. That might be because when you're outside looking at nature, you spend less time looking at things so close up, so you let your eyes rest more. Or it could be because sunlight slows eye growth, which could help eyes from unnaturally elongating. That's a cause of nearsightedness. Whatever the reason, consider this your excuse to take a break from your screens and go get outside in the sunshine.
Okay, well, I will take that. That's Life Kit's Andy Tagle. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hope it's helpful, Aisha.
A community in the deep red state of Wyoming has done something many people might find surprising these days. It's put up a new monument commemorating ethnic violence that happened there 140 years ago. Jenna McMurtry has this report.
Towering plateaus dotted with sagebrush and roaming wild horses surround the desert town of Rock Springs, Wyoming. Population, 23,000. The town dates to the 1860s, when nearby coal deposits lured thousands of immigrant laborers to mine it and build America's new transcontinental railroad lines. Rock Springs has long proudly called itself the home of 56 nationalities. It's had an International Day celebration for more than 100 years. But now the city is literally digging up a part of its migrant history that it hasn't wanted to acknowledge much until now.
Because of the need for Chinese labor, they built the Chinatown for these laborers to live in. And it was right here where we're standing.
Laura Ng, an archaeologist and professor from Iowa, is leading a new excavation of Rock Springs' old Chinatown.
The Chinese massacre that happened in 1885 destroyed that Chinatown through arson fire.
It was one of the deadliest incidents of anti-Chinese violence in U.S. history. A mob of white miners, businessmen, and their families set fire to Chinatown, killing those who did not flee. They blamed the Chinese for poor working conditions amid labor tensions with the Union Pacific Railroad.
The massacre not only involved, you know, the murder of at least 28 Chinese, the mob burned down most of Chinatown. So there's going to be a layer that is very distinctive in the archaeological record.
In what Ng calls the burn layer, she and her team are digging for remnants, like old Chinese dishware and burnt down foundations from the homes and shops that once lined the streets.
And it was right here where we're standing.
Ng is studying how federal immigration bans ahead of the massacre likely motivated the mob and fostered anti-Chinese sentiment. In the more recent past, Rock Springs shied away from this dark chapter in its history. It wasn't taught in local schools, but local high school students helped the town with a ceremony this fall to honor those killed in the massacre. More than 200 people came.
Whereas the preservation of memory and the honoring of those lost lives are among the highest duties of our community.
Rock Springs Mayor Max Mickelson says a memorial like this one is long overdue. And there's a tension he finds ironic.
As someone who is a descendant of immigrants that came to this country from Europe, I find it very frustrating that as a country, we have decided to take an anti-immigrant stance.
Rock Springs has hosted descendants of survivors of the massacre for a week-long series of commemoration events. But outside of town, anti-immigrant sentiment is growing. This year, the county sheriff renewed a contract with ICE, the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, to work with them to find and arrest people working here illegally. Wyoming State Highway Patrol and National Guard later followed suit.
I have lots of friends who came to America and are U.S. citizens when they were 14, 15, and we don't love America any more than those people. They worked really hard to get here.
And today, immigrant labor is still important to Rock Springs. The Census Bureau says just under 20% of the population is Hispanic or Latino. Mickelson calls himself an old school Republican, but says now is an awkward time to be a member of the party. He says there are more important issues to focus on, such as drug and human trafficking that have recently plagued his town.
I think we have real problem areas where those resources would be better put than tracking down somebody who is here working, putting up stucco.
Mickelson says that he, like 76% of the county he lives in, voted for President Trump in 2024. But the mayor says this crackdown wasn't what he voted for. At the Labor Day ceremony honoring those who died in the Rock Springs Chinese massacre, lion dancers performed, and a new statue was unveiled. It's a visual reminder of the Chinese history here, joining other statues and plaques celebrating some of the 55 other nationalities whose labor built the town.
Standing more than 7 feet tall, depicts a Chinese miner amidst the ruins of Chinatown, holding the remnants of a ceremonial dragon flag.
The archaeologists have been reaching out to descendants of the survivors to involve them in the dig. The majority had never heard about the massacre until recently. Robert Liu, who lives in California, was one of five who came to the ceremony.
I am now 75 years old.
He knew his father grew up in Rock Springs, but only learned that he is a descendant of a massacre survivor when he spoke to the archaeologists here.
But in terms of my great-grandfather in 1885 in the massacre, that was only 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
While here, Liu talked with a young man from Rock Springs, who said he wished more people were familiar with the massacre.
You know, in Wyoming, and what he said was very inspirational and make me feel really good about our country.
For NPR News, I'm Jenna McMurtry in Rock Springs.
Buying a home is a traditional milestone for couples. But as housing prices soar, many Americans are teaming up with someone who's not their romantic partner to buy a home, as NPR's Raina Cohen reports.
In August, Haley Currier and Tammy Kramer put in an offer on a house in Berkeley, California. Then came the waiting game.
We've done everything we can.
And all we can do is be anxious at each other.
Currier and Kramer are longtime friends who are in their late 30s. They bond over open water swimming, Jewish rituals, and political organizing. They've lived together for the last 9 months in a rental, along with one other roommate.
Such a beautiful community and like feeling of connection and home that I have here. And we have one bathroom.
Currier and Kramer share the same vision for a long-term home setup. Here's Currier.
But Tammy and I still have intertwined lives and lives that we get to build together, but just a little bit of private space also.
In March, they started looking for a place to buy. A significant number of Americans have done what these two friends are trying to do.
50% of buyers in 2024 bought their home with a friend or a relative.
This is Kara Ng. She's a senior economist at the real estate marketplace company Zillow. This 15% statistic comes from a survey that Zillow ran on tens of thousands of home buyers. Ng and other housing experts think so many people are co-buying because housing has become unaffordable. Home prices have risen more than 50% since 2020.
To put into context, 5 years ago, the median household would be able to buy a typical home with room to spare. And now the median owner would need a $17,000 raise in order to afford a typical home.
A $17,000 raise just to buy a home. In some parts of the country, it's even more extreme.
In California, the median earner would need a six-figure raise.
California is where Currier and Kramer are looking for a home. Affordability is an issue for Kramer.
There's very few single-family homes that I would be able to afford in the general region area that we're looking right now.
Another thing working against both her and Currier, they're not partnered. Here's Ng again.
There is a couple's advantage where if you're one person shopping for a home, the amount of listings you can afford is relatively small. But the moment you partner with another single person, it unlocks a whole lot of listings for you.
So co-buying is a workaround for single people like Currier and Kramer.
It's not something my generation did. You didn't buy property with someone else.
This is Sari Currier, Haley Currier's mother. She's right. Surveys show that co-buying with friends or relatives is more common for millennials than for people in older generations. She's worried about her daughter co-buying with Kramer because friends don't have the legal protections that married couples do. She wrote up a list of questions for her daughter and Kramer to discuss.
What if Tammy says she can't afford property tax? Is Haley liable for the whole amount? What if a problem inside one unit impacts the other? Who pays? What happens when one wants to sell the property?
How many questions would you say are on this list?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, between 25 and 30.
Sari Currier's concerns aren't unfounded. Co-buying a home does come with financial risks, and it can have financial advantages. But the decision often isn't all about money. That Zillow survey found that a major reason people co-bought, especially those who weren't partnered, was they didn't want to live alone. That describes Kramer. She'd lived on her own during the pandemic.
I missed the feeling of coming home to people, and I missed the feeling of sharing food and being in community.
That won't be a problem anymore. Currier and Kramer did not get the house they bid on earlier this summer. But in September, they sent me a voice memo.
We just got a house!
We just bought a house!
Specifically, two units on one lot with a shared yard. Raina Cohen, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is Sunday morning, and you're listening to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Our listeners love supporting the businesses that support KAXE. If you're interested in connecting with KAXE listeners, call 218-326-1234 Ask for Peggy, Jen, or Chris. Big thanks to all our current business supporters. The Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork hosts the Sketches of Minnesota Traveling Improv Comedy Tour Saturday, October 11th, beginning at 5 p.m. with a social hour and meal, followed by community conversation. Members of Danger Boat Productions will create an unscripted comedy routine based on these conversations. The event is free, but you must pre-register by October 5th at edgecenterarts.org/events. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE KBXE.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Ukraine fell under another large-scale Russian missile and drone attack overnight. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the attack targeted multiple regions. Kyiv appears to have been hit the hardest. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov spoke this weekend at the UN General Assembly in New York, saying Moscow does not intend to attack Europe, but he warned that any aggression against Russia would face a decisive response. A spate of airspace incursions linked to Russia has led to security concerns. And officials in southern India say a stampede at a political rally killed at least 39 people and injured dozens of others. The rally was for a popular Indian actor turned politician who was speaking when the crowd surged. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson loves desperate characters, like the frenzied capitalist in There Will Be Blood and the anxious romantic in Punch Drunk Love. Anderson's new film, One Battle After Another, centers on a panicked revolutionary. Critic Bob Mondello says that by the final credits, he's become so frantic, the film practically vibrates.
Bob is stoned when we meet him.
What I'm doing here is I'm creating a closed circuit.
But then that would have been true no matter when we met him.
Very important to keep your cap shunted like this so you don't accidentally detonate your charge.
He and his no-nonsense girlfriend, Perfidia Beverly Hills, are among the revolution-minded Californians in the early 2000s who call themselves the French 75. Perfidia, played by Deanna Taylor, is the group's fiercest warrior.
I kill him dead!
And Bob, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, is their explosives guy.
I want you to create a show.
Meaning fireworks.
This is an announcement of revolution.
When the group liberates an immigration detention center, he creates distractions while Perfidia neutralizes Camp Commander Lockjaw, who certainly lives up to that name. Played by Sean Penn, he's ramrod straight, and how can I say this delicately? Not just with regard to posture, he's got a thing for Perfidia, and she's just the woman to weaponize her allure.
I'll be seeing you very soon.
Not if I see you first.
The group members also rob banks, live their lives, all with varying levels of commitment. Bob's into family building, Perfidia into revolution, never more persuasively than when she's about 11 months pregnant, firing an automatic weapon in the desert.
What are you gonna do about this baby?
Flash forward to today. Perfidia's long since gone underground, leaving Bob, who is still as stoned as ever, to raise Willa. She is now a savvy 16-year-old, played by Chase Infinity, and she's chafing under Bob's lifelong paranoia that his past will come back to haunt her.
Sorry.
I didn't ask for this. That's just how the cards were rolled out for me.
It's not cards. You don't roll cards. It's dice.
Dad, what is wrong with you?
Things would be fine if Lockjaw weren't still out there looking for them, getting closer, too, as he curries favor with a bunch of military racial purity zealots, white nationalist creeps who call themselves the Christmas Adventurers, a name filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson uses to make them appear as laughable as they are horrifying.
We are here to award Stephen Lockjaw.
with the Medal of Honor.
Now you'll notice, and we're still in the film's first half hour or so, that Anderson's doing a lot of hot button pushing here. Immigration politics, leftist fanatics, reactionary extremists, racism, a militarized state, not to mention father-daughter tropes, and an action thriller he's made so propulsive, it's sometimes hard to keep your wits about you. Hard for poor reefer-addled Bob, too, when he needs to call for help from the French 75 after all these years.
What time is it?
Let's just not nitpick over the password stuff. Look, this is Bob Ferguson, all right? I need the rendezvous point.
What time is it?
DiCaprio gets funnier as Bob's desperation grows, whether he's galumphing after skateboarders dashing across rooftops or diving from car windows to escape the police.
Jump on four. Four! Slow down!
Just like Tom Cruise.
All while Anderson is inventing new genres on the fly, cartoonish and deadly serious, while sending characters careening down undulating desert highways in a uniquely nerve-jangling cinematic car chase. With There Will Be Blood, Magnolia, and Boogie Nights glistening on the director's resume, it would take a brave critic to claim that this is Paul Thomas Anderson's best film yet. But I guess I'm a brave critic. One battle after another is thrilling, hilarious, moving, politically scary as hell, and Paul Thomas Anderson's best film yet. I'm Bob Mondello.
Every September in Mexico, it's time to eat a national delicacy made of stuffed poblano peppers drowned in a creamy walnut sauce. Walnut sauce. But one of the ingredients for this dish is an endangered cactus. It's illegal to use it. Later today on All Things Considered, how some Mexican communities are finding ways to keep the tradition going. Tune in on your radio or tell your smart speaker to play NPR. Cemeteries might not be everyone's idea of fun, but for Argentine author Mariana Enriquez, they're full of life. They're a doorway into history, memory, and sometimes the supernatural. Enriquez, known for her chilling fiction, turns to real resting places around the world in her new nonfiction book, Somebody is Walking on Your Grave, a series of personal short stories she's collected over the years while traveling to cemeteries across four continents. Mariana Enriquez joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm very glad.
Why are you so interested in cemeteries? They seem like your favorite place to visit.
The first reason is I used to be a goth when I was young, like a goth from age 6 or something.
With the dark hair, dark, wearing black all the time sort of thing.
Reading Edgar Allan Poe. And then with the years, I learned that also cemeteries have a lot to say about life, about the history of the people. And then Argentina in the 70s, that is the decade where I was born, had a dictatorship that made a lot of bodies disappear. Therefore, there's a generation of people that were killed by the government and they don't have a grave. I realized that that trauma that is very engraved in my life somehow made me feel that a grave, a tombstone, it's something of comfort. It's a final thing in a good way. So between the very fun, goth kind of thing, there's also a deep reason for all this. And that's why I decided this could be a book.
In the book, you talk about the burial of your friend's mother, who was disappeared during Argentina's dictatorship. This is a deep philosophical question, but why do you think it matters that we find the body after all that time, that we have the burial? Why does that matter to us so much?
Because grieving is important. People don't go through that process. It's absolutely cruel. We don't know what happens after death. And the only comfort we have is the comfort of grieving, of paying respects, of having a place to go and remember. Memory, it's a right.
you visit a lot of cemeteries with all of this history, with colonial settlers, with the marginalized, the disappeared. They're all buried, maybe not side by side. How do you see, like, those distinctions in life, classism and all of this stuff, play out in cemeteries? And is there maybe one cemetery where you felt the contrast most striking?
Well, in every cemetery, you have, like, the rich at the beginning, or most of the time, the rich at the beginning with the marble, etc., the middle class, and then the people on the ground. But sometimes it's in different cemeteries, and New Orleans, for example. And then there's, for example, what happens a lot in post-colonial societies like Argentina or Australia. An island in Argentina is called Island Martin Garcia, and an island in Australia is called Rodney's Island. White settlers that have their cemetery with their colonial family saying they came from this and this place in Europe. And then you have a mostly unmarked, in the case of Australia, for the Aboriginals and from the indigenous people in Argentina. So, yes, you can see it sometimes in the same cemetery, sometimes in two cemeteries in the same town, but it's the same as life. That's what's very striking.
When you're going to these cemeteries, do you often meet people who are also have the same interest as you in cemeteries? Do you meet fellow travelers?
I do sometimes. Rarely. What you meet a lot is what I call peregrines. People that go this to see a special grave, and you are going to visit the same person. And sometimes you recognize each other, like we see each other. Yeah, there's a very strange kind. I guess I'm one of those strange people, too. But to me, the others look strange.
Well, you went to the Paris catacombs to see what remains of the Holy Innocents Cemetery. But you take a souvenir.
Oh, God, that's illegal.
Well, it's in the book, though.
I know, but you know, when things are in books, you can always say, well, it's a bit of fiction. I can say that, but this is a non-fiction book, so, you know, whatever. But I went to the catacombs, and I'm fascinated by this cemetery because it's featured in many, many books I love. And I said, okay, I'm going to take a little bone with me. I mean, I fully respect the people in the catacombs in Paris and stuff, but the security is not great.
Clearly,
because it was not difficult to do that.
You may not want to say if you still have it, because well, the authorities may be listening. But what do you think of something like that and the respect for the dead? Do you take that seriously?
Yes, of course, I think that the dead may be. It was a moment of insanity.
Okay, yes.
It's very wrong. But since I've been very respectful with it, but I also think, taking it more lightly, that sometimes I think when I'm doing these investigations and, you know, I'm walking there and taking my notes and seeing what's written on the graves and the fact that the dead are so lonely, sometimes I think that yes, that you can be a bit less solemn and respectful and go there and have a Coke and have a chat. There were people, they are people. And I think they would like a friend. It sounds weird, but it's not. I wouldn't like to be there lonely forever.
Because you could have some joy. Yeah, you could have some joy around you. Do you know where you want to be buried? I think you talk about this in the book. And how did you decide?
The cemetery of Recoleta in Buenos Aires, where Eva Perón is buried, among other people, but the most famous is Eva Perón, Evita. It's a very aristocratic cemetery, therefore you only can be buried there if you are a member of one of those aristocratic families, which I'm not. Since I'm not an aristocratic person, I have to occupy that. And the only way to occupy that cemetery is, you know, to have someone put my ashes there. And I want them to be thrown in a grave that it's a pyramid that says there's nothing here, only dust and bones, nothing.
That's Mariana Enriquez. Her new book, Somebody is Walking on Your Grave, comes out on Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you. It was great.
Julia Michaels has written hit songs about love for many artists, Selena Gomez, Britney Spears, Sabrina Carpenter, and more. But a recent heartbreak inspired a new song of her own.
I was in a relationship quite a while, and when we ended, I actually cried so much that I shocked my heart out of rhythm and had a minor heart surgery to fix it. No Heartbreaks Killed Me Yet is an anthem for resilience. Heartbreak sometimes doesn't always have to be sad. You can come out the other side and be like, oh, you know what? That person actually was really bad for me. And sometimes things need to end to make space for the things that are really great. In the interim of us breaking up and me having to have this heart surgery, I met my now fiance. He was there, slept next to me in the hospital the whole time and basically nursed me back to health. I grew up with a lot of different music in my house. I was homeschooled from middle school to high school, so from 16 years old, I was writing professionally with and for other people, and I'd never really been on stage. I'd never really performed live or in front of people. I always thought that I was gonna be one of those songwriters that you just kind of never know about. Just have some form of anonymity. And I was working with Haley Steinfeld. We were working on her first EP on Republic Records, and A&R there. I remember he came into the studio and he had heard one of the demos that we had done, and he heard my voice on it, and he looked at me and he was like, "You're a star." I think that I am known for being really raw and really vulnerable and for wearing my heart on my sleeve. With my new EP, I just put out Second Self, you can hear that I have a very satirical sense of humor. And who you are at one time isn't who you are at another time. People are always changing and evolving and going through so many different things. I've always tried to write songs for those moments in time, for those feelings in time. No Heartbreaks Killed Me Yet is definitely going to be the start of another era of music. I started my own label last year, and being able to put out my own music and have the freedom to do so has just been very liberating.
That's Julia Michaels talking about her new song, No Heartbreaks Killed Me Yet. And her EP, Second Self, is out now. This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Thank you.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234. There will be a candlelight vigil at Angel of Hope Park in Grand Rapids, Monday, October 6. Those grieving the loss of a child, no matter what age, and supporters will gather for a brief ceremony at 6 p.m.